This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Did You Ever Have a Family? By Bill Clegg. Read by the author.
For Van and for our families. You should have heard him. His voice was unforgettable, irresistible. His voice was an imaginary garden woven through with fragrance. Did you ever have a family? Their eyes are closed. That's how I know we're there, inside it. It's made of sound and steam that weaves between dark dining room, bright kitchen. We're there because I'm hungry, and we'll all be eating soon, together, and the hunger's sweet. Alan Shapiro, Song and Dance. Silas. He wakes to the sound of sirens. Many, loud, and very near. Then horns. Short, angry grunts like the buzzers signaling time out in the basketball games he watches but does not play in at school. His cell phone says 6:11 a.m. But the house downstairs is awake and loud, and from the particular pitch of his mother's rough morning voice, scratching above his father's and sister's, he knows something is wrong. Before he kicks off the covers, Silas grabs his yellow knapsack from under the bed. He pulls out the small, red bong his friend Ethan gave him last month for his 15th birthday, along with a bag of pot he smoked in less than a week, mostly on the job yanking weeds from flower beds and patios for rich New Yorkers. He selects a green bud from the small gray Tupperware container where he keeps his stash, carefully pinches it in half, and presses the larger piece into the metal bowl. He grabs the half-filled water bottle sitting on his nightstand and pours a few inches into the bong before lighting. As he inhales, he notices the smoke curl toward his mouth, thicken in the red tube, and turn, slowly, like a sheet twisting underwater. Once the bud has mostly turned to ash, he pulls the stem from the bong and releases the smoke to his lungs. The water gurgles at the bong's base, and he is careful to inhale gently to minimize the noise. He opens the window, snaps off the screen, and leans out, exhaling in one full, sloppy breath. He watches the smoke float before him, catch the wind, vanish. He feels the cool air against his face and neck, and waits for the pot to work its magic. The sky is pink and pale blue, and he traces a long trail of plane exhaust above him until it disappears over the roofline of the garage. The streaks are fluffy and loose, and so he thinks the plane must have flown over hours ago, before daybreak. To where, he wonders, the drug beginning to lozenge his thoughts. Below him, four beefy crows land gracelessly on the lawn. He watches them hop and step and tuck their wings into their chest-thick bodies. They are the size of house cats, he thinks, as he follows their quick mechanical movements. After a while, and for no apparent reason, they stop and stand perfectly still. He cannot see their eyes, but he senses they are staring at him. He stares back. They cock their heads from side to side as if making sense of what they see. Wind roughs their feathers from behind, and after a few hops they take flight. Airborne, they appear even larger, and for the first time he considers whether they might be hawks or vultures. Then, as if unmuted, birds of all kinds squawk and screech and chirp from every direction. Startled, Silas knocks the back of his head against the top of the window. He rubs the spot and leans farther out. Another siren, different from the others, higher pitched, more upset, screams from far off. He tries to locate the crows that have disappeared into the complicated morning sky. What he finds instead are familiar shapes in the streaks and billows. A mountainous pair of swelling breasts, cat-eyed sunglasses, a fiery bird with vast wings. Then he sees what looks like nothing but what it is. Smoke. Pitch black and thick, rising behind the roofline. At first he thinks his house is on fire, but when he leans out and looks back, He can see that the smoke is coming from beyond the trees on the other side of the property. Then he smells it, the oily stench of a fire burning more than just wood. He can taste it too, and as he inhales, it mingles with the pot smoke still on his tongue and in his throat. The birds get louder, squawking, yelling what sound like words. "Go! You! Go!" he thinks he hears, but knows it's impossible. He blinks his eyes open and shut, attempts to process each thing. The smoke, the smell, the birds, the sirens, the magnificent sky. Is he dreaming? Is this a nightmare? Is it the pot? He got it from Tess at the farm stand up the road, and her stuff is usually mellow, not like the trippy buds he and his friends drive an hour and a half south to score in Yonkers. He wishes he were having a nightmare or hallucinating, but he knows he's awake and what he sees is real. At the tree line on the other side of the house, smoke pumps into the sky like pollution from a cartoon smokestack. It puffs and thins, puffs and thins, then a terrible cloud, larger than the rest, swells from the same unseen source. It is dense, coal black, and faintly silver at the edges. As it rises, it expands into a greenish gray and then dissolves into a long, crooked wisp that points across the sky like the worst finger. Silas backs away from the window. Still wearing the shorts and t-shirt from the night before, he slips on his old gray and white New Balance running shoes, the ones he wears when he works his landscaping jobs or stacks firewood with his father. He looks in the mirror above his dresser and sees that his eyes are pinkish, bulging slightly, and his pupils are dilated. His unwashed for days dark blonde hair is jagged and oily, flat to his head in some places, standing on end in others. He rubs a stick of deodorant on his armpits and puts on his black corduroy Mohawk Mountain ski cap. He swigs the remaining water from the bottle by the bed and shoves a few sticks of big red gum in his mouth. He grabs the yellow knapsack and packs up his bong, his lighter, and the small Tupperware container. He rubs his eyes with both fists, breathes in deeply, exhales, and steps toward his bedroom door. His thumb and forefinger graze the knob, and he remembers the night before, where he was and what happened. He steps back, traces his last movements before falling asleep, runs through it all once and then again to make sure it is not a dream he is remembering. He considers and then dismisses the possibility of taking another bong hit before leaving his room. He stands still, speaks to himself in a whisper. "I'm okay. Everything's okay. Nothing's happened." Downstairs, his mother's iPhone rings innocently, like an old-fashioned phone. She answers on the third ring and the house falls silent. The only sounds now are the tireless sirens, the grunting horns, and the distant hum of helicopter blades beating the air. From the kitchen, his father shouts his name. Silas steps away from the door. June. She will go. Tuck into her Subaru wagon and roll down these twisting, potholed country roads until she finds a highway, points west and away. She will keep going for as long and as far as possible without a passport, since the one she had no longer exists. Her driver's license, along with everything else that had been in the house, is also gone, but she figures she won't need it unless she is pulled over for speeding. She had not planned on leaving this particular morning, but after she wakes and showers and slowly puts on the jeans and blue and white striped boat neck cotton jersey she has been wearing for weeks, she knows it's time. She washes and dries the chipped coffee mug, ceramic bowl, and old silver spoon she's been using since she came to this borrowed house. Feels the weight of each object as she places it carefully back in the cupboard or drawer. There is nothing to pack, nothing to organize or prepare. All she has with her is the clothing on her body and the linen jacket she wore 18 nights ago when she rushed from the house. As she slowly pushes her arms through the worn sleeves, she tries to remember why she put it on in the first place. Had it been cold in the kitchen? Had she pulled it from the overwhelmed coat rack by the porch door before chasing into the field, careful not to wake everyone upstairs? She can't remember, and as she starts reviewing the events of that night and the morning after, examining again each step with forensic attention, she forces herself to stop. That she has her cash card and car keys with her is luck. They had been in the jacket pockets, but she does not think of herself as lucky. No one does. Still, these stowaways from her old life allow her now to leave town, which is all she wants. It isn't restlessness or a desire to be somewhere else, but a blunt recognition that her time in this place has expired. Okay, she exhales, as if seeding a long, windless argument. She looks out the kitchen window at the orange and red daylilies blooming behind this house that is not hers. She presses her hands against the rim of the sink, and in the basement the dryer she'd filled over an hour ago with wet sheets signals its duty done with one long, harsh bleat. The porcelain feels cool under her palms. The house without sound is now loud with nothing, no one. A molten ache turns in her chest, scrapes slowly. Outside, the daylilies flail in the morning wind. She has not cried, not that day, not at the funerals, not after. She has said little, has had few words when she needs them, so she finds herself only able to nod, shake her head, and wave the concerned and curious away as she would marauding gnats. The fire chief and police officer answered questions more than asked them. The old stove, gas leaking through the night and filling like liquid the first floor of the house. A spark, most likely from an electric switch or lighter, though none had been found. The explosion, the instant and all-consuming fire. They did not ask her why she was the only one outside the house at 5:45 in the morning. But when the officer asked if her boyfriend Luke had any reason to want to harm her or her family, she stood and walked out of the church hall, where a makeshift crisis center had been created. This is the church where her daughter Lolly would have been married that day. Across the road and a short walk from the house. Guests had shown up before 1 o'clock expecting a wedding, and found instead a parking lot filled with police sedans, ambulances, fire trucks, and news vans. She remembers walking out of the church toward her friend Liz, who was waiting in her car. She remembers how talk stopped and people shuffled and half-stepped out of her way. She heard her name called out, timidly, unsure, but she did not stop or turn around to respond. She sensed sharply as she reached the far side of the parking lot, an untouchable. Not from scorn or fear, but from the obscenity of the loss. It was inconsolable, and the daunting completeness of it, everyone, gone, silenced even those most used to calamity. She could feel all eyes on her as she opened the car door to get in. She remembers seeing in her peripheral vision a woman coming toward her, holding up her hand. Seated, she could see clearly through the car window Luke's mother, Lydia. Busty, bright bloused, long brown hair piled loosely on her head. This was the second time she'd seen her that day, and as before, despite a powerful urge to go to her, there was no way she could face the woman. "Go," was all she could say to Liz, who sat in the driver's seat spellbound and mute like everyone else in the parking lot. The police never questioned her again about what happened that night and the following morning. Friends stopped asking her the same safe questions. Was she okay? Did she need anything? When she didn't respond. A thin smile, a blank stare, and turning her head away discouraged even the most persistent. A morning news anchor was especially pushy. "People want to know how you're surviving." This woman, who had been on television since the 70s, but had not one crease or line on her face, said to her in front of the funeral home, "No one survived," she said in response, and then quietly, "Stop," which the woman did. Eventually, everyone who had been in town for Lolly's wedding left. The questions ended, and she was, at the age of 52, and for the first time in her life, alone. Through that first week and after, she refused to wail or fall apart or in any way begin a process that would bring her closer to rejoining the new and now empty world. Or, as someone urged in a well-meaning but unsigned note that accompanied one of the hundreds of funeral arrangements, to begin again. She buttons her jacket and starts to close and lock the windows of the small cottage loaned to her by a painter she once represented. "For as long as you need," Maxine said that day over Liz's cell phone, "the place is yours." Maxine was in Minneapolis, where she'd been when everything happened. How she found out so fast and knew what was needed, June still did not know. Some people, she decided, magically surface in these horrible moments, knowing exactly what to do, which spaces to fill. The cottage was on the other side of Wells, the same small town in Litchfield County, Connecticut, where her house had been, where she'd come on weekends for 19 years and had been living full-time for the last three. Maxine's dusty little place is far away and unfamiliar enough for these weeks to be bearable. That anything could be bearable was a shameful minute-to-minute revelation. How am I here? Why? She allows these questions, but she keeps others from herself. It is safer to ask the ones she doesn't have the answers to. She has refused to be admitted to the town hospital, or to take any of the sedatives or mood stabilizers the few people around her have urged her to let them have a doctor prescribe. There is nothing to stabilize, she thinks, nothing to be stable for. In the cottage, she has slept past noon each day, and after waking, moved from bed to chair, to kitchen table, to couch, and eventually back to bed again. She has occupied space, tolerated each minute until the next one arrived, and then the next. She switches off the kitchen light, locks the front door, and places the key under the geranium pot plopped haphazardly toward the edge of the stoop. She walks from the house to her car reluctantly, recognizing that these steps are likely the last she will take in what remains of her life here. She listens for birds, and as she does, wonders what she expects to hear. Farewells? Curses? The birds see everything, she thinks, and for now they are silent. Under the high canopy of black locust trees that stretch between the cottage and the driveway where her car is parked, there is little sound save for the faint buzz of fading cicadas, who had weeks ago emerged from their 17-year slumber to mate, fill the world with their electric hum, and die. Their sudden appearance had seemed like a beautiful omen the week before Lolly's wedding, when the slow early summer news cycle seemed to talk about little else. Their last gasp now seems as fitting as their arrival was then. June rushes the last steps and yanks the driver's side door open before slamming it shut behind her. She fiddles with the keys, unable at first to find the right one. She eyes the four on the ring as if each has betrayed her, one for the Subaru, one for the front door of her house, one for Luke's truck, and an old one she still had from her last rental in the city. She wrestles all but the Subaru key off the ring and drops them in the cup holder next to her seat. She turns the key in the ignition, and as the machine rumbles to life beneath and around her, she recognizes again that she is awake and in the world, not stumbling through some outlandish nightmare. "This is the world," she says to herself with grim wonder, touching the steering wheel dully with her fingers. She backs the black Subaru out of the driveway, shifts from reverse to drive, and inches slowly along the narrow dirt road until she pulls onto Route 4. She fills the gas tank at a full-service station in Cornwall and drives until merging south onto Route 7, with its swoops and curves and steep grassy banks. On an empty stretch of road, she fishes the three keys from the cup holder, opens the passenger seat window, and in one swift motion tosses them from the car. She closes the window, presses her foot harder on the gas pedal, and speeds past two spotted fawns, stumbling several yards from their mother. For as long as she's been driving between Connecticut and Manhattan, dozens of deer have grazed alongside this stretch of road, oblivious to the speeding cars a few feet away. How many times had one darted into traffic, she thinks, imagining all the close calls, the ones she's had, and the countless others everyone who's driven this road has survived, thanking God and exhaling as they sped safely away. She thinks of the unlucky souls who didn't speed away, and the staggering catastrophes these stupid and beautiful creatures must have caused. She accelerates, pushing past the speed limit, 52, 58, 66. And as the wagon shudders, she considers how many people have actually died here, their bodies dragged from twisted metal, charred into objects no longer resembling human beings. Her palms get damp against the steering wheel, and she wipes each one on her jeans. Her light jacket feels tight and constricting, but she does not want to stop the car to take it off. She passes another grouping of deer, a doe and a young buck with their spindle-legged fawn. And as she does, she imagines the wreckage, shattered glass, smoking tires, survivors identifying bodies. Her breathing is quick and shallow, and she broils inside her clothes. South of Kent Village, she comes upon an open stretch of road, fields of summer corn fanning out in tight rows from either side. The wagon approaches 70, and the windows rattle in their wells. She imagines, with more detail than she wishes she were capable of, a sea of yellow crime scene tape, police car and fire engine lights, the spark and smoke of road flares, ambulances lined up with EMTs standing by, useless. She pictures the dazed survivors, aimlessly stumbling. She circles each one, agitating with questions. Who had been driving? Who looked away at exactly the wrong instant? Who fiddled with the radio instead of paying attention? Who leaned over to find a mint in a purse or a lighter, and by doing so lost everyone that mattered? How many, she wonders, stepped from the wreckage without a bruise or scrape? And of these lucky and living, who had been in the middle of a quarrel just before the moment of impact? Who had been fighting with someone they loved, going at it long enough to unleash the irretrievable words they knew to say only because they had been trusted to know what would hurt the most? Words that cut quick and deep, inflicting damage that only time could repair. But now there was none. These people, she mutters, somewhere between curse and consolation. She can see them crouching along the roadside, doubled over and alone. Sweat soaks her clothes, and her hands tremble on the wheel. An oncoming car flashes its headlights, and she remembers that a speeding ticket will end her flight. She has no identification, no social security card or birth certificate, which would be the least she'd need to secure a new driver's license. She slows the wagon to 55 and lets a green pickup truck pass. Had the driver seen the flashing headlights? Judging by how fast he was going, she doubts he had. We never pay attention to the right things, she thinks, as she watches the truck vanish beyond the bend ahead. Until it's too late. She opens her side window, and air blows through the car, chilling her damp skin and tossing the shoulder-length, blonde and silver hair she's worn in a short ponytail and not washed for weeks. To her right, the Housatonic River snakes closely alongside the unruly road, midday sun sparking off its lazy currents. She relaxes, less from the coolness in the air and more from its turbulence. She opens the passenger seat window, and feeling the added chaos, opens the remaining two behind her. Wind explodes through the car. She remembers Lolly's long ago Etch-a-Sketch, and how upset she became once when a friend shook it and the mysterious sandy insides wiped clean whatever careful scribble she had made there. She remembers Lolly screaming, piercing, wild, indignant, and how she refused to be consoled or touched. It would be over a year before Lolly would allow that friend back for a playdate. Even young, her daughter held grudges. June closes her eyes and imagines the wind-blasted car as an Etch-a-Sketch hurling forward, the rough air wiping her clean. She hears that particular sound of shaken sand against plastic and metal, and momentarily the trick works. Her mind empties. The imagined roadside calamities and their self-pitying culprits vanish. Even Lolly, tear-streaked and furious, disappears. June settles deeper into her seat and slows the car just below the speed limit. She passes a farm stand, a newish CVS where a video store once stood. Miles of crumbling stone walls, and a dusty white house with the same pink-painted sign in front that has been there for as long as she can remember. Crystals stenciled in pale blue underneath black letters that spell Rock Shop. For years, these were the things she saw on this drive, each marking the distance between the two lives that had for so long passed as one. She tries again to summon the Etch-a-Sketch, this time to erase the memory of all the giddy Friday afternoon flights from the city and the too soon Sunday evening returns with Lolly in the back seat, Adam in front, driving too fast, as always, and June pivoting between them, talking about teachers and coaches at school, which movie to see that night, what to eat. Those car rides flew by and were the least complicated part of their lives. The memory of them steals her breath, surprises her with an ache for a time she almost never remembers fondly. If it could only have been as simple as that, the three of them in a car heading home. The river disappears from view and she slows the car to 20 as she approaches the half-mile stretch that everyone who travels this road regularly knows is a speed trap. She crosses from Kent into New Milford and passes the McDonald's she has long considered the unofficial border between country and suburb. In the parking lot, children climb from the open doors of a dark green van like clowns out of a circus car and stand restlessly before a row of elaborate motorcycles parked in front. A young man jogs beyond them, a sturdy chocolate lab keeping perfect pace by his side. They cross in front of an old gas station, boarded up and empty, the pumps removed. June remembers stopping there twice, maybe three times in the year she's been driving this road, but cannot remember its going out of business. Weeds have sprung up in the cracked pavement of its parking lot, and she notices the lab circle a scruffy bunch of dandelions and grass, on which he lifts his leg and pees. His master jogs patiently in place a few yards away. The light ahead blinks red, and she slows to a halt behind another Subaru wagon, this one dark green, newer, and filled with what appear to be teenagers. She avoids looking at them and instead focuses on the blue Connecticut license plate and the Nantucket ferry stickers peeling on the back window. A siren signaling noon sounds from a nearby fire station. It starts low and soft, like a French horn, and builds gradually to a high, wide wail, so loud and overwhelming she covers her ears with the thin linen sleeves of her coat. The light finally turns green. And as it does, she closes all the windows. The bus driver behind her taps his horn, once, politely, and she eases her foot from the brake until the car begins to roll forward. The siren dies. The air inside the car is still again. She passes restaurants and clothing stores and supermarkets she's driven past for decades but never entered. Open signs hang from windows. Garlands of tiny multicolored flags snap in the wind above a Cadillac dealership. Through the rearview mirror, she watches it all get smaller. Edith. They wanted daisies in jelly jars. Local daisies in 50 or so jelly jars they'd collected after they were engaged. Seemed childish to me, especially since June Reed wasn't exactly putting her daughter's wedding together on a shoestring. But who was I to have an opinion? Putting daisies in jelly jars is hardly high-level flower arranging. More like monkey work if you want to know the truth. Still, work is work, and the flower business around here is thin, so you take what you can get. The jars were at June's place, stored in boxes in the old stone shed next to the kitchen. I was supposed to bring the daisies that morning and arrange them on the tables in the tent beside the house once the linens and play settings had been laid. I'd picked them the day before from the field behind my sister's house, which is chock full of the things. I've never been much of a fan of daisies. They've always struck me as bright weeds more than actual flowers. Never mind that they're cheap, but for a wedding, they're not appropriate. Roses and lilies and chrysanthemums, even tulips and lilacs if you're going for something less fancy. But daisies? No. I remember when the two of them came into the shop, hands held, dripping with dew. She looked like her mother, but curvier. June has, at least as far as I can remember, more of a boyish figure. And he was just fine, perfectly handsome, I suppose, in the way that nice, clean-cut boys who went to college can be. They were young. That was the strongest impression they made on me. I didn't think people got married that young anymore. At least not from well-to-do families. Local girls with no plans and knocked up, that's one thing. But a Vassar girl with a job at a magazine in New York, and a law student at Columbia? These are not the types of kids you see rushing willy-nilly to the altar. But they certainly were sweet together, and had a cloud of luck and love around them that not only stung a little, old bitter spinster that I am, but surprised me. That kind of affection is not something you see so much around here. Local couples, even the young ones, are worn out from two jobs, school schedules, family obligations, and too much debt. And the older ones, with their late mortgage payments to make, propane gas tanks to be filled, and sons and daughters skipping school and smashing cars and getting in fights at the tap, are too tired, not to mention too busy performing their roles as jolly country folk on the weekends for the pampered and demanding New Yorkers, spending every last drop of civility and patience on these strangers, with none left over for their wives and husbands. The weekenders from the city not only take the best houses, views, food, and yes, flowers our little town has to offer, but they take the best of us, too. They arrive at the end of each week texting and calling from trains and cars with their demands. Driveways to be plowed, wood to stack, lawns to mow, gutters needing cleaning, kids to be babysat, groceries to be bought, houses to be cleaned, pillows needing fluffing. For some, we even put up their Christmas trees after Thanksgiving and take them away after New Year's. They never dirty their hands with any of the things the rest of us have to, nor shoulder the actual weight of anything. We can't bear them, and yet we are borne by them. It makes for a testy pact that for the most part works. But every once in a while there are some slips. Like when Cindy Showalter, a waitress at the Owl Inn, spat in the face of an old woman who muttered something insulting under her breath when Cindy did not understand the type of cheese the woman was asking for. "Who has ever heard of an explorer cheese?" she asked me at church. I shook my head and later went on the internet to find a cheese called Explorator, which I'm sure has never been served in any restaurant around here. There was also the fire that broke out in the barn at Holly Farm and killed three horses. No one ever proved it, but we all know it was Mac Ellis, the former caretaker, who set the place ablaze after being fired by Noreen Schiff for padding the receipts each month. He'd done it for years, apparently, and her accountant in the city finally caught on. He never got arrested, but word got out and he lost a few jobs. "There's a lot of resentment simmering underneath the smiles, and so good to see yous, and no problem, happy to do that's of this town. So when someone crosses the line, it can get uncomfortable." Many people, the younger girls mostly, felt June Reed had crossed a line when she started up with Luke Morey. They always made a fuss about him. He was good-looking, I'll give you that. Not a surprise, since Lydia's father was devil-handsome in his day, and Lydia has always been what men seem to find attractive. Even so, much of Luke's looks came from the fact that he didn't look like anyone else around here. He was like a wild orchid growing in a hayfield. No one ever knew who his father was, but they sure knew he was black. I hate to say what it suggests about this town that there is virtually no one who could have been the father. The older couple in Cornwall, dead now, were retired scientists from Boston, and mixed, her black, him white, and the principal's adopted son Seth, he's black, but was only 6 or 7 when Luke was born. This was our town at the time, which no one much thought of, to be honest, except in instances that exposed it, like when Lydia Morey had her baby. It's been at least 3 decades since that boy was born, but nothing much, at least on that front, has changed. More weekenders, of course, fewer local families, who one by one have sold their farms and land and houses to people who spend maybe a few weeks total in them every year. Saturdays and Sundays, a week or two in the summer, the truth is that most of the houses in this town stand empty. They blink with security gizmos, are scrubbed and dusted and jammed to the ceiling with beautiful furniture, but there's no one home. I drove down South Main Street a few months ago, middle of the week, 9 o'clock in the evening after supper at my sister's house, and not a light on anywhere. The moon was out, so I could see the chimney tops and the dormers, but one after the next, all the way down to the town green, dark. It occurred to me that night, and since, that we no longer live in a town, not a real one anyway. We live in a pricey museum, one that's only open on weekends, and we are its janitors. It used to be that most of the big old houses in Wells were owned and lived in by local families. I ought to know, because I grew up in one. Granted, it was the rectory at St. David's where my father served as rector for over 30 years. But back then the job came with a 6-bedroom house with 4 fireplaces and a barn down in back. Now there's a rector, some woman called Jessie, if you can believe it, who splits her time between 3 churches and lives in an apartment in Litchfield. The church rents out the rectory to a young family from the city who come up, yes, you guessed it, on weekends. Of course they have never, not once to my eye anyway, stepped into St. David's, which is hardly surprising since there are only 15 or so of us who still come Sunday morning. Like the houses along the green, the old church sits empty save for a handful of hours on weekends. My father retired years ago and died not long after, but I still go every Sunday. I kept his old key, so I let myself in early and set up the altar flowers with whatever is unsold from the shop and on its way to the garbage. No one can see wilting petals from the pews. It might shock some of the old-timers at St. David's to find out that I gave up on God a long time ago, when my mother started to disappear into Alzheimer's, which has to be the slowest, cruelest way out there is. She started to go when I was in high school and died a week after my 40th birthday. By then, and for a long time before, she was unrecognizable. Angry, awful, and completely dependent on me. My sister went to college, and I stayed home to help with what my father was too proud and cheap to hire anyone else to do. Not that I needed one, but it's not exactly easy to find a boyfriend, let alone a husband, when you're living as an unpaid round-the-clock nurse in your parents' house. I don't waste my time wishing things had gone differently, and I don't pretend that if I'd prayed any harder, it would have. I've been on my own without God's help or a husband for a long time now. Most of the people I grew up with have moved to Torrington, or across the state line to Millerton or Armenia, and even those towns are getting expensive. But some manage to burrow into the corners of the town, tuck into its folds, and stay, as I have. Lydia Morey has too, though it's hard to imagine why. She's the last of her family around here, and by family I don't mean Morey. It's amazing to me she kept that name. She's a Hannafin and she knows it. Who can guess what that woman was ever thinking? So her choice to keep the name is no more of a surprise than her choosing to stick around after she gave birth to that black baby boy. When Luke was born, it was clear to everyone that Lydia's husband, red-headed, freckle-faced Earl Morey, was not the father. He packed Lydia's bags that very night and told her not to come back. She went straight from the maternity ward to her mother's couch. Her mother was still around then, and she took them both in for a while, but she made no secret of her disgust. She worked as a teller at the bank in those days, and you could hear her carrying on at the drive-thru to anyone who'd listen about her lunatic daughter, who she was certain had gotten caught up with cults and black men and God knows what. Everyone sided with Earl, who comes from a big family that's been around here forever, and Lydia Morey was for a while as banished as one can be in a town of 1,500 people, half of whom barely live here. Over time, people came around, for the most part. Luke was always liked, especially there for a bit in high school when he was breaking state records for swimming, and even, I think, being whispered about for the Olympics. But Lydia remained a loner, save for a few poor choices in the man department. To be fair, the pickings are slim around here, and the poor woman, pretty as she is, did the best she could. With pickings this slim, someone like Luke Morey, once he finally cleaned up his act, became a prize goose at the fair to the women in town. His skin was definitely his father's, whoever that was, but he had his mother's wide-set green eyes and high cheekbones. Add to that at least 6 feet and a somewhat successful landscaping business, and you've got enough to turn a few heads. He turned heads his whole life, but never so much as when he went to jail, just a few months after high school, and then later when he moved in with June Reed, who was over 20 years his senior and from the city. From the time that boy was born, he was the talk of the town. And given what happened, how he went, and how many he took with him, he always will be. When I drove over to June Reed's that morning with the daisies and saw the nightmare surrounding her property, all that smoke, the old stone house destroyed by fire, the empty tent, I did not stop. I just kept driving. Without thinking, I drove straight to my sister's place, where we sat and drank a pot of mint tea, picked fresh from her garden. She'd already been called, by whom I don't know, and she told me what happened. Killed. All of them. The young couple, June's ex-husband, and that doomed Luke Morey. For a long time, we just sat and watched the steam rise from our mother's old pale green china teacups. Later, I walked out the back door and into the field behind her house. I was out there for hours, unsure what to do or where to go. I wandered through the high grass and all those horrible daisies, from the woodline to the road, back and forth, running my old wrinkled hands over all those bright and unlucky weeds. Eventually I came in, I stayed the night, and the next night too. The daisies did not go to waste. Every single one was put to use. They never did see the inside of any jelly jars, but they found their way into 100 or more funeral arrangements. Even when no one asked for them, and let's face it, most did not, I still found a way to make them work. No one ever accused me of being a soft touch, but when something like what happened at June Reed's that morning happens, you feel right away like the smallest, weakest person in the world. That nothing you do could possibly matter, that nothing matters. Which is why, when you stumble upon something you can do, you do it. So that's what I did. Lydia. They arrive before she knows they are there. She has no idea when exactly they settled in at the table by the window, two down from the one where she sits nursing her cold cup of coffee. But it's long enough ago that they have ordered soups and salads and been served their cups of tea. They are behind her. She cannot see them. But by their polite laughter, she knows it's tea they are sipping, not coffee. Soups and salads they have ordered, not hamburgers and fries or the meatloaf. She doesn't know these particular women, these mothers and daughters and wives, but she knows them. She has cleaned their houses, ferried their children to train stations and sleepovers, and yanked the weeds from their sidewalks for most of her life. She has heard them fret about global warming, mercury levels in tuna, and pesticides choking the life out of the lettuce they stab with their forks but barely eat. She has witnessed up close their girlish and convincing surprise at the arrival of each relentless windfall and victory. A husband's unexpected bonus at the end of the year, the new station wagon in the driveway strung up with birthday or Christmas or Mother's Day ribbons. What she finds the most difficult to bear is hearing them brag about their children, their early acceptances to impossible-to-get-into schools, the job offers from prestigious law firms, the promotions and awards, the engagements to attractive people from happy families, their weddings. It is a wedding they are talking about now. The loud one, the one that begins every sentence with, "Now." Now, you'll never believe. Now, Carol, listen to this. Now, I never. Now, can you imagine? Now, hear this, she seems to be commanding each time she speaks. As if her voice, 2 or 3 decibel levels above the clank and chatter of the restaurant, didn't already demand your attention. She has a daughter getting married in Nantucket. From the shimmy in her voice, Lydia can tell it is this woman's favorite thing to talk about. Thank God for the wedding planner, bossy like you wouldn't believe, but a genius with the details. She even helped organize the honeymoon, a gift from the groom's parents, a month in Asia. To be honest, I think it's too much. The whole thing waiting like a giant game show prize on the other side of what we expect to be a perfectly nice, but by no means over-the-top wedding. They're from New Jersey, she explains. Big Italian family, she adds, and just in case anyone missed the point, they don't know any better. She keeps going. The trip is endless. Her voice is a furrowed brow, bragging. India, Vietnam, Thailand. Each country's name rolling off her tongue like the brand names of pricey clothing Lydia sees ads for in the thick beauty magazines, these women drop on the bathroom floor like just once used towels. As she continues on about the groom's family, the limousine service they've owned since the 1950s, their accents, their Catholicism, Lydia looks out the window to the only motel in town, the Betsy. The sign is large and wooden and covered in white paint that has been cracked and peeling for as long as she's lived here, which is always. The sign has a large pediment on top, as if announcing a grand colonial inn, and not the 21-room, one-story white brick motel that sits out of sight beyond the tree line at the end of the drive. Nothing is grand about the Betsy except maybe the room numbers painted in robin's egg blue with gold borders on the small oval plaques hanging from each door. The owner's mother fancied herself a folk artist, and they were a gift to her son Tommy when he opened the motel in the late 60s. He told Lydia the story one night at the Tap, a few years after he sold the place. Lydia had cleaned the rooms there for 6 or 7 years before the new owners came in and hired Mexicans, who arrive on foot each morning from across the state line in Amenia or Millerton. She'd never said much to Tommy when she worked for him, nor he to her, but since time had passed and they were both bellied up to the same bar, he got chatty. "I hated that color blue," he spat, many drinks in and looking like a 65-year-old teenager. Gray hair, liver spots, cracking voice, bright blue eyes. Lost. Wearing the same white button-down shirt and khaki pants she remembered him wearing in church when she was a kid. She covered everything in that blue and insisted I put her silly paintings in the rooms. She even painted flowers on some of the beds. I named the place after her thinking it would open her purse a bit more, but it didn't. I was supposed to live off the earnings, but there never were any. No one comes to Wells to stay in a motel. Everyone in town knew Betsy Ball had long ago married the heir to a liquor fortune, who died young and left her everything. Tommy lived with his mother most of his life, sleeping in the same bedroom he slept in as a child, in the house he still lived in. Lydia wondered if he ever left that room, ever moved to another one in a different part of that big brick house on South Main Street after his mother died. Except for 4 years in Pennsylvania for college, and a few years after in the city, Tommy Ball never really left town. Never dated anyone that anyone can remember and never married. Betsy Ball saw Tommy every day, and he hated her, Lydia thought. Her son hated her, but she was not alone. Even when the town library, to which she eventually left a good deal of money, threw her a party for her 100th birthday, her son arrived and left with her. She was widowed and deaf, probably wearing diapers and not knowing her own name, but she did not go home alone that night. Alone and home is where Lydia has been the most during the last 6 months since Luke died. She walks to the coffee shop after lunch most days to get a break from the television, which has become like a full-time job. If the morning talk shows start without her, she feels like she's dropping the ball, as if she's failed in the one measly duty she has each day. There aren't as many of the old-time Phil Donahue-type shows anymore, the kind with regular people with extraordinary problems. Now the shows are more specific. Medical, food-focused, or exclusively dedicated to celebrities who at times feel like family, like cousins you hear about in Christmas letters doing this and that, who you catch glimpses of at graduation parties, christenings, or weddings. It comforts Lydia to see the same people pop up on the same couches and guest chairs through the years. They age, she ages, the talk show hosts age. For a little while, it seems like they are all in it together. Now, did you know the caterer never got paid? At first, she thinks the loud one is still talking about her daughter's wedding in Nantucket. But she's moved on to the past tense, another subject, a different wedding. It is soon clear which one. Lydia scans the place for the waitress, the pregnant blonde named Amy, who she's pretty sure used to work at the grocery store. She sees her each day, and keeps meaning to ask, but after she orders her coffee, she can't ever seem to find the words. Lately, Amy just brings the coffee, which excuses both of them from speaking. The lunch crowd has mostly left. Lydia pivots back slightly, careful not to turn all the way around and be seen by the loud one or any of the women with her. She still doesn't know quite who they are, but given what they are now talking about, she doesn't want to be recognized. She wants to leave as quickly and quietly as possible. She looks again toward the kitchen, hoping to see Amy and signal for the check, but there is no one. She's stuck, and there is nothing she can do to keep from hearing this woman, who seems to not even take the shortest breath between her words. "I don't think the tent was burned, but the big oak tree behind the house caught fire. They still haven't cut down what's left. It stands there, black and horrible, like some scary Halloween decoration. Now can you imagine? My brother used to work for Luke Morey." Someone else is speaking now, someone younger. "He was at the house the day before it happened, with his friends, mowing the lawn, picking up sticks, weeding the flower beds. Silas still won't talk about it. He's only 15. The police asked him questions, the fire marshal too, but he didn't know anything. He worked for Luke for 3 summers. Lydia thought this kind of talk had died down. And even if it hadn't, she wasn't usually within earshot to hear it. Most people, if they saw her coming, changed the subject or got quiet. She'd become used to conversations ending abruptly and eyes looking away from her as she passed people in the pharmacy and grocery store, or even here at the coffee shop. But these women don't see her. Amy must be resting. The lunch rush looked like it had been busy, and she's at least 5 months along. Lydia remembers cleaning houses until her 9th month and going back to work with Luke when he was only 2 weeks old. She had to. Earl had thrown her out without a penny, and no one blamed him. Luke's biological father didn't know he existed, nor would he ever, and her mother had been barely scraping by on what she made at the bank. Lydia and her mother had been on their own for as long as she could remember. Her father died of a heart attack soon after she was born, and all he left behind was debt. An outstanding loan with the bank and payments on the truck he used to plow driveways with in the winter to make money. "There is no pension plan when you sell firewood and plow snow for a living," Lydia's mother would say when she was paying bills and smoking cigarettes at the table in her kitchen. "He worked hard," was half of the only other comment she made about Patrick Hannafin, who was, from the few photographs Lydia had seen, the source of her dark brown hair and high, sharp cheekbones. In every photograph he looked the same, handsome, tall, serious. "He worked hard," Natalie Hannafin would say of her late husband. But his hands were allergic to money. His family had been in Wells since the 1800s, and at one time there had been as many of them as Morey's. But over the years, sickness and wanderlust, and more baby girls born than boys, dwindled the fold, and now Lydia was the last Hannafin standing. Still, Lydia's mother insisted she keep Earl Morey's name after the divorce, and that Luke keep it too. It made no sense, and what was worse was that it seemed like an aggressive stance to take against a family who not only took their name seriously, but didn't take any more kindly to an open challenge than they did infidelity. Lydia knew her mother held out some tissue-thin hope that Earl would change his mind, forgive her daughter, and take Lydia and Luke back. Retaining that name was her one demand at the time, and because her apartment was the only place Lydia could go after the hospital, she agreed. Lydia slept on her mother's couch for 6 months, and since there was no money for a sitter, Lydia would bring Luke with her to the Betsy and into the houses she cleaned, still in his car seat, setting him on kitchen counters, window seats, and beds while she worked. Her mother always said the boy could sleep through a war. The loud one is at it again, filling everyone in on the details. The same grim facts the papers and the New York and Connecticut news stations repeated for months. A gas leak, an explosion, 4 people dead, a young couple to be married later that day, the mother of the bride standing on the lawn watching it happen, her ex-husband asleep upstairs, and her boyfriend in the kitchen. "An ex-con," she makes sure to emphasize. "And black, not that it matters," she adds in a whisper. "My God," she can hear one of them say quietly. "What a nightmare," she hears another mumble with what Lydia imagines is a slowly shaking head and crossed arms. Finally, the 4th woman speaks. She must be the only one not from around here, Lydia thinks, and it must be for her benefit that these women are so painstakingly reporting the story. "How do you recover from that? How would you even begin?" Lydia puts both hands in her lap and closes her eyes as the loud one winds up. You don't. That's how. And she didn't. Now, can you imagine watching everyone you love just disappear? Have you ever even heard of such a thing? There's nothing she can do to stop them. Nothing she can do to shut them up or shut them down. They are like the horseflies that circle her head when she walks along the town green in the summer. They dart and poke and buzz and dive, keeping pace no matter how slowly or quickly she moves. She's left town, apparently. West or south or something. After the funeral, she just vanished. For a few long seconds, there is silence. The clang of lunch dishes being washed and stacked in the kitchen. The gentle beeping sound of a delivery truck backing up somewhere. There was an investigation, says the woman, who does not sound at all familiar, but who must be from Wells or nearby to assume the role of storyteller. There's no hard proof, but it looks like it was that black boy she was seeing. And forgive me, he was a boy. And on the one hand, good for her. But look what happened. Do you really think it was his fault? The younger one asks, nervously. Since she spoke about her brother earlier, she has remained silent. Silas says Luke was a good boss. Our mother disagrees, but Silas liked him. Now, come on. I don't think anyone really doubts that it was his doing. He was the one in the kitchen. Everyone else was asleep. And besides, he'd been in prison. For using drugs. Dealing. The whole shebang. Cocaine or crack or methamphetamines or something. They were quite a pair. She ran art galleries in the city and I think she moved up here full time. To be with him, no doubt. How would a woman like that end up with a local thug like him anyway? The fourth one asks, as if on cue. How do you think? Now hear this, Lydia has shouted, the words not even hers. She is standing, her chair scraping like a scream as she rises, turning to face these women. Now, she shouts again, her voice a shock to her ears, the loudest sound she has made in many months. When was the last time she even spoke? Yesterday? Last week? She is standing in front of these four women. Three of them near her age, mid-50s, early-60s, and one of them much younger, in her 20s, the only one she recognizes. Her name is Holly, and Lydia grew up with her mother, who was a few years older and never friendly. Seconds pass as she stands in this now almost empty coffee shop before a table of women, who, besides Holly, she imagines have not once worked a day of physical labor, who have been attended by loving parents and friends, and colleagues, and boyfriends, and husbands, and children, and grandchildren, every pampered, taken-for-granted minute of their lives. These are comfortable women, cherished women. They look at her as if the forks in their hands have told them to be quiet. I'm sorry, who are you? The loud one, attempting to impose order, breaks the silence and deflates Lydia's momentary authority. Who am I? Lydia thinks. I'm nothing. I've never been anyone except someone's housekeeper, daughter, wife, girlfriend, or mother, and in all those roles I have failed and now I play no role. Her knees are twitching, and she can smell her sharp body odor. She is standing before these women with nothing to say beyond the demand that they listen. Holly begins to speak. Lydia, I mean, Mrs. Morey, I'm so... As she speaks her name, Lydia's face flashes with heat, and a panic that registers as physical pain knuckles through her chest. Before another word is spoken, she turns away, shakily places a sweaty $5 bill on the table, and as she does, mumbles, "That thug is my son."
"Excuse me? What did you say?"
The loud one asks, her voice high, tight, scolding more than curious. Lydia turns to face her. "My son, you stupid bitch. He was my son." She steps toward her as she says the words. And when she sees the woman flinch, she realizes that her hand is raised, her palm open. She stops abruptly and hurries as quickly and as steadily as she can manage toward the door, out across the shopping center parking lot, and onto the sidewalk that leads home. She has heard, finally, what she feared people believed. It took more than 6 months for the words to reach her ears, and now that they have, she needs to get as far away from them as she can. She has no one